Greetings from the hot Pine Barrens of southern New Jersey, and welcome to the second hour of Far Out Radio. I'm Scott, and today is Friday. It's July the 5th, 2013. Hope you had a great day. James Corbett of CorbettReport.com is our guest for the second hour. Making sense of what's going on in our world has never been easy. There's a concept in metaphysical thinking that says that perspective adds wisdom to any given situation. Well, when you live in a big nation such as the United States of America, with its enormous, homogenized corporate and government-controlled mass media, it can be very difficult to get an honest read on current events. Therefore, it's a very good thing and beneficial to get perspectives from outside the United States on geopolitical situations. James Corbett is a Canadian educator and has been living and working in Japan since 2004. In 2007, James launched CorbettReport.com as a platform for his independent analysis of social, political, historical, and economic issues. He's written and produced over 1,000 hours of audio and video presentations. James is with us tonight to talk about his life, his work, and his observations as a Canadian living on the opposite side of the world from North America. James' commentary, video, and audio presentations are always astute, concise, and informative, and his background as an educator consistently comes through his material, as we always learn from James Corbett's work. So be sure to go and visit his website. It's CorbettReport.com. James, you're there. Welcome to the program.
I'm here indeed, Scott. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for that kind introduction.
You're quite welcome, and gosh, this Skype thing makes it sound like you're in my living room instead of the other side of the world. That's just amazing. You know, the other night I was listening to a Jeff Rentz program from about 3 or 4 years ago, and he had a guest on that was using Skype, and it was awful. It was just terrible, and I don't know why, but they have vastly improved it to the point where, you know, you're in Japan and I'm here in New Jersey, and sound like you're in the other room. So we're making progress, right?
We are, but I think it might come with a cost, because of course Skype was bought out by Microsoft for $8 billion, and there's a lot of rumors about the infrastructure being changed to allow for FBI access. So everything comes with a bit of price.
Yeah. So listen in, guys. Maybe you'll learn something. Maybe we can flip them. You know?
Let's inform some people tonight.
Right. James, what was going on in your life that caused you to move from Canada to Japan?
Well, it actually started when I was in Ireland. I went to Ireland for a year to do some postgraduate study. I was studying Anglo-Irish literature. So I was, in fact, in Dublin and deciding what to do once I returned back to Canada. And I ran into one of my friends on campus one day randomly and asked him what he was doing. And he said he was looking into the possibility of teaching in Asia. And I thought that sounded like a pretty good gig indeed. As I had never been to Asia, I still had the travel bug in me. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life yet at that point. So I thought, well, why not spend a year living in Asia, teaching, traveling a bit, seeing some more of the world, and then getting on with the rest of my life. And so, so I actually went right then and there and went and did a little searching online, found some possibilities, ended up eventually applying, and got a job teaching English in Japan. And so I went back to Canada for a few months, and then got ready and basically packed up and headed out the door to Japan. And originally it was going to be a 1-year deal, but after the first year, I really enjoyed it here in Japan. And then after the second year, I still enjoyed it. And the third year, and the fourth year, and the fifth year. And eventually it's been 9 years now since I first came out here. And now I have a wife and child, and I'm pretty much settled in here. So you never know when where things are going to take you. But decisions come from very small beginnings.
Sometimes they do. Well, good for you. That's nice. With recent events of, in Fukushima, it's now drawn the world's attention to the island of Japan. If you're a news hound, most people have a sense of where Fukushima is located. It's on the east coast of the island. Where are you located in reference to Fukushima and Tokyo, so our listeners can get an idea of sort of kind of where you are?
Well, I'm on the west side of the main island, so if people are familiar with Japan, it's about halfway between Osaka and Hiroshima. So that puts me about 400 miles south-southwest of Fukushima. And that's actually probably one of the best places in Japan to be, considering when the radiation was still leaking out into the atmosphere, the winds were basically carrying them eastward rather than out here out west. So mm-hmm. So it was not a bad position to be in that regard. And right now, I think, of course, for many months now, the real main concern has been the ocean contamination and what's going on with the fish there. So, of course, my wife and I are very careful about what we're eating these days. And now mm-hmm. there's even the possibility of groundwater contamination. So there's a lot to worry about still from Fukushima.
Yeah, you've got those nuclear reactors that have melted into the ground, and I don't know if there's any way at all you can get them out, let alone what to do with them. It's really quite an amazing thing.
It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing. Not in a good way, of course, but right. it quite fearful what can be done. But absolutely, three of the six reactors went into a total meltdown. And they don't know exactly where the cores of those reactors are, but they believe they're within the containment, but are within inches of going through that containment. So it was quite a hair-raising situation, and of course it's not over yet, as there's still leaks basically going straight out into the ocean, and there's every day, I think, new reports of fish and radiation and all sorts of horrific things happening. So I actually have a website, FukushimaUpdate.com, specifically tracking what's happening at Fukushima.
Good. That's a good service to those who are interested and care about this thing. You know, when this thing happened 2 years ago, two years and a few months ago, I remember, in retrospect, oh, silly me, I kept waiting for a news story to come out on the MSN about, a special meeting was convened at the United Nations where they issued a clarion call to all the world's top scientists to, get out here because we got a problem to solve. We got to fix this thing, yesterday. And it never happened.
No, it didn't. It certainly didn't unfold like that. They've very much respected Japanese boundaries, I suppose you would say, on this issue. And there has been some UN kind of token presence here, but certainly nothing along the lines of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was within a couple of months after the initial accident over there, Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, the company that made the built and designed the reactors, went over there and he made a grand announcement and statement saying that a year from now, these reactors will be rebuilt and it'll be better than ever. And I guess everybody, applauded and went on their merry way. here we are over 2 years later, and it seems like they're still scratching their head. I don't get it. I just don't understand it.
Well, it will take decades at the very least to even get a handle on what can be done with the cores, and then, of course, it will still be thousands of years that they will be radioactive. So there's a very big question of what can possibly be done at this point, and they're still debating all sorts of ideas, but so far there's just very little progress, and the progress mm-hmm. that is being made is maddeningly slow, including of course the progress in trying to remove the fuel rods from reactor 4, where they were in the spent fuel pool that's in the containment facility, which itself is teetering and on the verge of collapse and mm-hmm. could potentially collapse sometime between now and when they actually remove those fuel rods, which is pretty important because even the spent fuel rods, of course, are still radioactive, and there's enough of them to make quite an incredible mess if the building were to collapse. So there's still that to worry about between now and at least December when they start removing those fuel rods.
Or there's always the possibility of another good shake. I mean, that is the...
It's absolutely, of course. It's something that's very, very possible because, of course, that fault line is still active. And it's, as we've seen, unfortunately, it's capable of some incredible tectonic movement there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've observed in the last 2 years is that as a result of this accident, it has brought to the forefront of attention the inherent dangers in just about all nuclear power plants. And one of the things that has come out is that they all leak radioactive material, all of them. And what we can do about it, I don't know. Try to stay away from them, I suppose, but good luck, you know?
Pretty much. Well, there are some ideas out there. Perhaps we can talk about them.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about that on the other side of the break. We've got some music playing. James Corbett is with us this evening. We're talking about his life and his work, and you can follow his efforts at CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. He's got lots of archives and articles, and he's quite an interesting fellow. So we'll get more into this on the other side of the commercial break. Be right back. Okay, gang, we are back with another segment with our friend James Corbett. We're talking about his website, his work, and on the other side of the break, we left off. We were talking about what we can do about living near these nuclear power plants.
You have some ideas, James.
Yes.
Well, I unfortunately don't have great ideas about living near nuclear power plants, but I do think that it's quite obvious that the nuclear power plants that have been developed have developed around the nuclear weapons industry. Basically, the type of design that has been used for nuclear power since its inception, since the Atoms for Peace program and all of that back in the 50s, promising energy too cheap to meter, which somehow failed to materialize, it has fundamentally been structured around the uranium fuel cycle for producing plutonium, which is of course the basis for nuclear fuel for nuclear weapons. And this is basically why we have had the reactors that we have, which are fundamentally unstable and extremely volatile, as we've seen at Fukushima and Chernobyl and many other places, unfortunately, besides. And so this has been a terrible thorn in the side of humanity. Whereas if you were looking at alternatives to that, there are other materials that could be used as the basis for the nuclear fuel in the nuclear fuel cycle, including thorium-232, which can be used to create and sustain an artificial nuclear reaction. Basically, an artificial uranium isotope, U-233, can be used to sustain a thorium reaction. And the interesting part of thorium nuclear reactors is that basically, unlike a uranium reactor, which you have to work at actively to try to control and contain the nuclear reaction that's happening in the reactor, with the thorium reactor, you actually have to work to keep it going. So it comes with a kind of built-in safety switch, where if there's some sort of disruption to the plant, instead of things going out of control like they did at Fukushima, the reaction would simply stop. And so this makes more sense from every possible perspective. And there are engineering problems to thorium reactors, but these are not problems that couldn't have been overcome with the type of research that went into developing the uranium reactors. If that had gone into developing thorium reactors, I think we'd be having a very different conversation right now. But that was never the research energy was funneled into, because of course it didn't result in any benefit for the nuclear weapons industry. So unfortunately, I think what we've arrived at is the situation where the nuclear weapons industry has gone hand in hand with the nuclear energy industry, to the point where I think they're basically inseparable at this point. And I don't think the United States or any country really wants to give up their access to these nuclear weapons material producing plants that we have in existence today.
That's another interesting detail that's come out in the last 2 years since the Fukushima accident, is that these plants essentially, aside from generating electricity by boiling water, are also creating material that can be then used for nuclear weapons.
Exactly right. And that's interesting to note in the Japanese situation, because of course Japan is a nuclear free country. They have nuclear energy, but of course not nuclear weapons, and of course they don't have a nuclear weapons program. But they have the nuclear infrastructure that if and when they were ever to turn that over to the production of nuclear weapons, they would be able to basically on the drop of a hat start producing nuclear weapons. And this has been pointed out by numerous people, including Joseph Trento, who I interviewed a year or two ago for my website, and he did some research into a secret weapons material exchange that went on quite illegally between the U.S. and Japan for decades, illegal both in Japan and the United States, but that didn't actually stop it from happening. And plutonium was shipped to Japan over the process of decades, to the point where basically Japan has a nuclear weapons program all ready to go when and if they should ever need to do that.
Wow. The things that make it go well.
It's quite horrific, really, what's done behind the scenes. Perhaps not surprising to people who understand how the system works, but still pretty horrific.
Yeah, it goes to show you that ignorance is bliss, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, enough of that stuff. So your Corvette report. I'm sorry. I have a website that's called my Corvette report. So if I slip, it's because I've been talking about Corvette report for years now. Your Corvette report's been active since what, 2007? You've got a lot of material on there.
That's right. 6 years of material now. So I've just reached episode 274 of my weekly podcast, which is kind of the flagship of the website. I've had almost 700 interviews, over 800 videos now. So yeah, thousands and thousands of hours of completely free media that's freely available for download.
That's amazing. Amazing. And you get to meet a lot of interesting people, too.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I never explicitly thought about when I started the website. But of course, it does give me an excuse to start contacting all these people that I'd been listening to on the radio or reading their writing. Suddenly, I had an excuse to contact them and ask them for an interview. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised how many people are perfectly willing to do that, even with someone relatively unknown like myself. And all it took was me to write an email to them and ask them kindly. So it's been a remarkable experience for me. And I always say that if nothing else, even if this website is useful for no one else on the planet, although I have had feedback to the contrary, but even if it weren't useful for anyone, it's still very useful for me. At the very least, researching the weekly podcast and having to do that research has made me do research that I'm sure I never would have had the ability or the excuse to do in any other context. So I have learned so much personally from doing this over the past 7 years now that it's 6 years. It's been an incredible experience for me, and I've grown so much in terms of my own experience through this. And I've had a lot of feedback over the years from people who have similarly learned a lot from the program. So that's the best feedback I can possibly get, is when people say that this has changed their political ideology or their outlook on the world, and they're starting to look at information in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's completely consistent with our experience, and we've only been doing Far Out Radio now since the beginning of this year. But in preparing to talk to people, you've got to read their book or at least go through it and come up with things to talk about. And it's just been a great experience. And it gives you, doing the program gives you cachet to pretty much approach almost anyone that you're interested in. So it's a really neat thing to do, but it is a lot of work, as you well know.
It certainly is. Well, I got to sleep at 4 a.m. last night, so.
Oh, boy. And now it's what, 8:30 in the morning for you?
That's right.
Oh, boy. Oh, well. Okay, James, we've got some music playing in the background, which means we're going to do a little bit of business work. And on the other side, let's get into some current event stuff, and we'll take it from there. We'll be right back, folks, with more Far Out Radio. Okay, folks, we're back with another segment of FarOutRadio.com, and we're talking this evening with James Corbett from Japan, but we're talking about his work and current events. All right, James, there's so much stuff on the plate in the last couple of weeks. Where would you like to begin? We can go into Syria or Eddie Snowden or Michael Hastings. What's hot on your end?
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about Snowden, given that that has been preoccupying the world media for weeks now. Sure. And perhaps this is coming to some sort of resolution insofar as Iceland, the Icelandic parliament has just apparently voted down the idea of opening the question of giving Snowden citizenship until at least September. They've put that off for until after the summer recess, so it's looking extremely unlikely that he's going to end up there now, which whittles down the possible candidates of countries that might accept him by yet one more candidate. And I always thought that that was probably the most likely place that he would end up. Mm-hmm. So that's that. I guess that can't be good news from his perspective. And this probably means that once again, there's pretty much nowhere that he can go, and no way that he can get there by this point. And of course, we saw the taking down of the Bolivian airplane with the president on board to search the plane in Europe as he tried to cross over French and Spanish airspace. So. Just incredible stuff happening right now in the name of this international manhunt. And it does, of course, make you wonder, because the manhunt itself really does play into the U.S.'s hands insofar as it probably serves its purpose of scaring any would-be future whistleblowers in the national security establishment into at least thinking twice about what will happen to them if they should ever blow the whistle. So the more that we concentrate on the Edward Snowden drama and less on what's actually the NSA is actually doing, I think the more it plays into the U.S. government's hands.
Indeed it does. He may well end up becoming a man without a country. I mean, how long can he stay at the airport in Russia?
I'm sure it would have driven me crazy by now already, but I guess we'll find out. And I imagine it can't be forever. We'll put it that way. But the longer he holds out, I guess the more he becomes some sort of icon, and continues to distract from the real issues of NSA spying. So I'm not sure that's what he wants in the end. It's a bizarre situation, and certainly the idea has been floated that Edward Snowden may not be the real deal, that this may be an intelligence operative who is merely fulfilling a role in leaking documents about things that we basically already knew from other whistleblowers. And that's, I think that's a key point. I mean, I have no idea whether Edward Snowden is an operative or whether he's the real deal or what the case may be. But I do know that we have had numerous NSA whistleblowers over the years, from people like J. Kirk Wybie and William Binney to Thomas Drake and Russell Tice, talking at great length about how the NSA is building up the technological capability to record and store all electronic communications passing through the United States. And in fact, there have been numerous statements that basically these whistleblowers had thought that that would probably be a possibility by 2015, but it turns out the NSA is already doing it, as we now know from numerous sources, and even from an interesting little segment that aired on CNN a few weeks before the Edward Snowden scandal started. They were discussing the Boston bombers case, and they were talking about the FBI and whether they would have access to a phone conversation that one of the bombing suspects' wives had with the bomber in the weeks prior to the Boston bombing. And Tim Clemente, who is an ex-FBI agent, who was on talking with what's her name, Carol Burnett on CNN, and they were talking about that, and he kind of let slip that, oh yes, the FBI could go back and listen to that conversation, which kind of stunned, was it Aaron Burnett on CNN?
Aaron.
Yes, Aaron Burnett, yeah, Aaron. That's it. And that stunned her. She asked for clarification, and he had to admit that the FBI in national security cases like this would have the ability to go back and listen to any phone call that had taken place by anyone in the United States, which is a pretty major bombshell to drop. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, we get Edward Snowden and some prison documents about metadata. No, the point is they can actually listen to the content of any phone call they want at any time they want to. So this is the real reality of what we're living through right now that is being somewhat obscured. And the one of the most amazing parts of all of this is that in the wake of this, one of the original NSA whistleblowers, in fact, the first NSA whistleblower to come forward by name, Russell Tice, who came forward in 2005, and was one of the sources that James Risen and Eric Lichtblau used for their original reporting on the warrantless wiretapping scandal. He came forward in 2009 to drop a little bit more of the story and say that, well, in fact, the NSA is listening specifically to journalists as well. So he preceded the AP spying story and everything that's played out from that by a few years. And now in the wake of the Snowden scandal, he came out on BoilingFrogsPost.com and then in a follow-up interview on my own website to talk about some of the people, some of the high-ranking congressional officials, judicial members of the judiciary, people in high-ranking military, basically top-ranking military brass in the Pentagon, and even a little-known senator from Illinois by the name of Barack Obama, were all being wiretapped as far back as 2004. So again, the current president of the United States was being wiretapped by the NSA a decade ago. So of course, this raises all of the questions about blackmail and what is really at the base of the United States government and the entire system, really, that there has been this shadow government that's developed behind the scenes for well over half a century now, since the invocation of the National Security Act in 1947. And this has basically built up that entire secret shadow government behind the scenes that, in many ways, probably wields most of the power over the government that we see, because it is able to work completely off the books and behind the scenes, and is able to dig up any dirt that they want on any politician they want and use that against them at key opportune moments. So I think that this is an extremely exceptionally important story. It did get a little bit of coverage. Huffington Post picked it up, the Blaze Drudge Report, but somehow the Russell Tice story and revelations don't seem to be quite as important for the mainstream media as the Edward Snowden documents. So I think that we're seeing right now the covering up of a pretty huge part of this NSA scandal by the mainstream media, by focusing exclusively on Snowden.
You're absolutely right. You know, I said right from the very beginning, because there was just so much attention put on this guy, and you know, high school dropout, and he's making $200,000 a year as a consultant, and because he's a genius, and you know, and they let this guy in to see everything. It just didn't seem quite right. And you know, very quickly I said to Karen, this guy sounds like a straw man to me. I mean, I don't know. We'll have to just wait and see, but you know, it certainly is playing out that way.
That's basically my take. And again, I think the proof will be in the pudding. And they say that there's going to be some even bigger scandals to come from the documents. So we'll have to see.
Well, it's always good to have something to look forward to. So there you go, folks. Okay, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be back with James Corbett for our last segment in just a few minutes. Okay, we are back, and this is our last segment with James Corbett. And you can keep up with all James' work at CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. There is a ton of material to read and listen to and watch and enjoy and learn. Okay, James, poor Eddie Snowden. I don't know. Where do you want to go from here? Do you want to touch on Michael Hastings or get right into Syria?
Let's talk about Hastings a little bit, because I just put out a fresh podcast episode looking into his very mysterious, very untimely death at the ripe, tender young age of 33. So a very, 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 very bizarre car crash that took the life of this very interesting journalist. And I must admit, he's a journalist that I never really looked deeply into his career until, of course, the fiery flames of the car crash that took his life prompted me to look more closely into what he'd been talking about. And lo and behold, it turns out that Michael Hastings was what I think is really the real deal when it comes to mainstream journalists who have left the reservation and are really trying to kick back against the establishment system. And if you go back and listen to some of his interviews from the past few years, he really does spill the beans about some of his own insight into what took place, for example, when he was in the Newsweek office during the run-up to the Iraq War. And he said that basically there were big pedigree journalists there who had basically spent their entire careers railing against the very type of thing that was happening there in Iraq, who were basically falling in line as if you were flipping a light switch to get them to fall in line with what was happening there. And he railed against this, and he did some very important reporting, and in the last few months of his life was giving increasingly interesting interviews, even in mainstream outlets on MSNBC and other places, where he was really laying into the Obama administration and calling it out for what it was. And lo and behold, he puts out an email saying that he believes he's being investigated by the FBI. He's on the biggest story of his career regarding the CIA. And a few hours after that email, he ends up dying in this car crash that is bizarre in so many ways. I mean, firstly, he's driving a new Mercedes C250, which is known for its safety features. But somehow, not only did the car explode into a fireball on impact with the tree, but in fact, there's a witness that said that the car was on fire before it even hit the tree, and then the flames only went higher after the impact. Also, of course, apparently, he was not only going near top speed by the time he crossed the final intersection before hitting the tree, but apparently there was a sudden burst of acceleration, and then he veered off course, out of control, and slammed straight into the tree. So there's every indication that there was something untoward going on here. And then what I found to be even more bizarre than all of that is, in the wake of this, the Huffington Post actually contacted former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark to get his comment on it. And he came out and said that what happened to Michael Hastings is consistent with a car cyber attack. The idea that the car was hacked into remotely, and the acceleration, the brakes, all of those systems can be basically controlled remotely, because so many of these systems are now electronically controlled and controlled via computer systems on board. And so researchers back in 2011, in fact, at the University of San Diego and the University of Washington, actually conducted research to show how easy it was to hack into a car's electronic control systems, and that this type of thing is perfectly possible. And now we have the counterterrorism czar coming out and saying that it's consistent with a cyber attack, and that the intelligence agencies of the major powers, including, of course, the United States, have the ability to do this, which is, I mean, a pretty amazing admission. And I can't imagine why the Huffington Post contacted him for this comment or why he gave it. But there you go. We have a very high-ranking former U.S. government official basically confirming that this type of attack is at least possible. And, of course, not confirming that this is what happened to Michael Hastings, but it is within the realm of possibility, even though the accident was immediately ruled to be an accident only.
Wasn't the engine, like, down the street somewhere?
That's right. Depending on what report you're reading, anywhere between 50 feet and 60 yards away from where the car ended up. So, for example, I mean, one of Michael Hastings' friends who revealed the existence of this email that he sent out just hours before dying, he has taken it upon himself to, for example, write Mercedes to try to find out, do they think this is a normal crash scenario for a Mercedes car? Are they supposed to explode into flames upon impact? Do engine blocks generally tend to fly 50 yards outside of the car when they hit a tree, etc.? Is this something that Mercedes would expect? Which is the type of questioning, I mean, you would expect that any competent reporter would be doing on this issue, but apparently not, because the reporters are content to sit on the sidelines and, I guess, wait for the official pronouncements from the investigators at the scene.
Indeed. For our listeners, what James is explaining is not far-fetched. I'm also a car guy, okay? A couple months ago, I'm reading a road test about a luxury high-performance sedan that a road tester had for a weekend. He was in California, and he was out one day up in the mountains, in the canyons, driving briskly, shall we say. It's a high-performance luxury sedan, capable as all get out of maneuvering curves at a high rate of speed. He's enjoying this car. Everything's fine. And he gets a message coming through the car's communication system asking him if he was okay. And he said, yeah, I think it was OnStar. They said, are you okay? He said, yeah, I'm fine. Well, I'm just driving. Why? And they said, oh, well, we had an indication that your car was experiencing some abnormally high G-forces in the side-to-side lateral movement, and we thought maybe you had gone off the road. So here he is just driving his car, and they're watching.
They're watching.
They thought he was in trouble. So,
and anyone who thinks they're not listening as well would, I think, be naive. Exactly right. And in fact, I think one of the most interesting things that I have in this podcast episode is a clip from DARPA. In fact, a program manager at DARPA who gave a lecture a few years ago, and I include some footage of this lecture talking about the car hacking phenomenon. And one of the things that she reveals is that, they were even able to create a music file that sounds like a song when you play it in your CD player at home or in your computer or what have you. But if you burn it onto a CD and play that in the car, it can be engineered with a virus that then takes over and infects your car's systems. So there are all sorts of ways that this could be done. And unfortunately, now that so many of these components are electronic and controlled by basically computers onboard computers, they're susceptible to the same types of hacking and viruses that your home computer are.
Extraordinary. That's it. I'm going back to a bicycle. I've had it.
Yeah.
Or keeping my old car. But and then you can very well imagine, you know, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch for to build a case where, like, well, now next year all Americans are going to be obligated to purchase health insurance because it's the right thing to do, of course. You could also make the same case that all Americans should drive brand new cars because they're safer, you know.
Exactly. No, that's exactly how these types of new systems are brought in board. And even if that's not the case, certainly this will be grandfathered in. So eventually, within 10 to 20 years, pretty much everyone will be driving these newer versions of cars.
Mm-hmm. Yikes. I don't know. I know it's a brave new world. And sometimes, I don't know if it's just me being older and not liking it and, you know, being a curmudgeon or is something wrong here, but it certainly has a stinky smell to it. To me, it does, at least, but that's just me.
Well, and to me as well, and to a lot of people. And again, I think it serves all of us to look into these types of things when they occur and to not get put off by that, you know, conspiracy theorist label or to shy away from looking into these things, because obviously, demonstrably, the mainstream media isn't going to do that. So I think it's incumbent on us to just not accept the first version of whatever we hear and to look a little bit deeper. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there was anything untoward here. It's certainly a possibility that Michael Hastings actually just crashed. But there's a lot that doesn't add up there and a lot that needs to be answered, including what he was working on, who he told, what notes he might have had, and any details of the investigation he was involved in would, I think, need to be examined in this case. But again, I'm not holding my breath for the mainstream media to start really uncovering any of this.
And if it ends up being uncovered or ferreted out by the alternative media, then there's all the reason to not pay any attention to it. But, oh, well, you know, it's just, you know, all that internet stuff, you know, you can't believe all that nonsense that people like on the Corbett Report talk about and Far Out Radio. That's just kooky stuff.
That's sad, yeah. but I think that
is.
I think it's truly changing. I really do think that. I can even see from the 6 years that I've been involved in this at the Corbett Report that there's truly a sea change taking place in terms of where people are sourcing information and what type of information they're looking at. And every single month, there's new polls coming out showing that people are less and less confident in television news, in newspapers, mm-hmm. in traditional news media, and more receiving a greater and greater share of their news and information from the internet. So I think this is a hopeful thing, ultimately. Of course, it always raises the question of what is being done to try to clamp down on the free flow of information on the internet, and I think there's a lot of things we have to be concerned about on that front. But at least for the time being, I really do think that the momentum is on our side, and we really are breaking down barriers that have been there for decades, if not centuries, in terms of the control of information that has hitherto been accomplished by relatively few people in the key editorial positions at a lot of these gatekeeper establishment media outlets. And that function in society is really breaking down as the alternative media rises online. So we are in a brief window of opportunity, but a window nonetheless, and I think we should be using it to our maximum advantage.
And one of the best things, listeners, that you can do to get your own thinker back is to stop watching the mainstream media news and start to read, and think for yourself, and you'll get your brain back. James, we're out of time. Thanks so much. I know it was a little bit of a challenge hooking up with you, you know, all the back and forth stuff, but it was well worth it, and I hope we can get you back again soon.
Absolutely. Well, anytime you need me, just let me know. I'm happy to come on and answer anything, any questions you might have about the land of the rising sun.
We will do that. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Take care.